We are talking once again with Maria Tomczyk, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
No job this week?
No job this week. He's recovering from some minor surgery that he had. So I expect he'll be recovered and with us next week.
Very good. So, luckily, still plenty to cover, or maybe unluckily, depending on your viewpoint.
Depends on your viewpoint, yeah.
All right. So starting with city council.
Yeah, so we'll start with the city council this week. One of the things that they did this week at their full council meeting was they looked at the regional committee and board assignments that each council member would be a member of. So they do this every time the council goes through an election and there are new council members. They shift assignments to committee meetings within the council, but also to the local boards that some council members sit on, the King County boards, and the regional boards as well. And I'm just going to talk a little bit about those assignments, just to remind people that there's more to being a Seattle City Council member than just doing work internally on the City Council to propose and vote on legislation and to do the hearings and take testimony and so forth that the City Council does. The council members also represent the city's interests on several county, regional, and state committees and boards, as well as a few local ones here within the city of Seattle. So this week, the full council voted on the list of new appointments to those committees and boards, and I just wanted to highlight a few of those. So there are some assignments that are related to whatever committee a council member chairs within the city council. So an example of that, or some examples of that, is first off, Lisa Herbold. She's the chair of the council's public safety committee. So she was reappointed to the local police pension board and the firefighters pension board because those fall under public safety here in the city. She will also now again sit on the regional law, safety, and justice committee, which looks at policy for the region, particularly King County, and tries to coordinate a response to certain trends in criminal justice. So, for example, looking at the trend of drug trafficking or human trafficking, would be folks sitting on that board would be looking at ways to coordinate a response that isn't just, you know, within the city of Seattle, but is region wide.
Would that be the body that would be focusing on corporate crime? Because that doesn't seem to get much focus.
No, I think you'd probably have to go to the state level to Attorney General Bob Ferguson's office to find some real coordination on that issue. They're looking more towards local trends. One of the things there that is a big part of the regional criminal justice policy is looking at shifting to diversion programs. So Lisa Herbold also will be sitting on the Let Everyone Advance with Dignity policy consulting group that's overseeing the implementation of diversion programs, not just in the city of Seattle, but looking at it in King County and perhaps a broader region. So that is one of the trends that the Regional Law, Safety, and Justice Committee is looking at. Now, also, Herbold's committee covers human services on her committee on the city council. So she will also sit on the local domestic violence prevention council, the King County Board of Health, and the King County Regional Homelessness Authority governing committee, along with Andrew Lewis. So Andrew Lewis, who sits on the city council's homelessness committee, he's going to be the other council member on the King County Regional Homelessness Authority governing committee. Lisa Herbold and Andrew Lewis are the two main representatives to that body. Now, another example is Alex Peterson. He chairs the Transportation Committee within the City Council. So he's going to sit on the local Move Seattle Levy Oversight Committee. That's just kind of naturally falls in the purview of the person who chairs the Transportation Committee on the council. And he will also be a member of the Regional Seashore Transportation Forum. and the King County Regional Transit Committee, which oversees Metro Transit. He will also sit on the Puget Sound Regional Council's Transportation Policy Board. So that's the policy, that's the policy board that looks at transportation within the Puget Sound region. So that's the four county area of King, Pierce, Snohomish, and Kitsap counties. So trying to figure out a way to coordinate, issues related to transportation, not just roads and, road infrastructure, but also transit and other transportation infrastructure like bridges and regional rail and so forth. Now, Teresa Mosqueda, she chairs within the City Council, the Council's Finance and Housing Committee. She's going to be sitting on the Affordable Housing Committee of the Growth Management Planning Council. She will also sit on the Economic and Revenue Forecast Council. That's when she's wearing her finance hat, along with Council President Deborah Juarez. So that's kind of an interesting pair there. Mm-hmm. The Economic and Revenue Forecast Council is the group that comes up. They look, try to look at what the economic climate is, and they try to come up with a forecast of how much tax revenue is going to be available for the city and the county to use for their budget projections. Okay. And Teresa Mosqueda has in the past complained about how the city, budget office doesn't come up with what she views as accurate projections of what revenue is going to be, and that they take a too conservative approach and lowball, or in the case of this past year, they highball it so that allows the mayor to allocate funds where she wants to, the priority she wants them to go to, and then sends her budget to the council. And then once the council gets it, the revenue forecast drops. And so they have to go through her budget and cut items rather than add in items if there's more revenue than expected. And that is, in her mind, is playing a political game where the mayor gets to propose a beautiful budget. The city council then has to be the stooge that comes in and cuts it, which affects how citizens view the city council versus the mayor. So Teresa Mosqueda has decided that she really needs to look harder at how the numbers are forecast for tax revenue, and to play an active role in that and make sure that it's a fair forecast, not an overly glowing forecast or an under forecast. Yeah, and then there's her foil, Deborah Juarez, who tends to kind of lean more towards the side of business and was more of a supporter of Mayor Durkan than Mosqueda was. So it'll be interesting to see if they duke it out a little bit on the Revenue Forecast Council. I don't know. I mean, they may get along very well on the council, or may respectfully disagree with one another, or they could end up duking it out. We'll see. Now, Tammy Morales, within the city council, her committee is the Neighborhoods, Education, Civil Rights, and Culture Committee. So she will also be sitting on the Local Families, Education, Preschool, and Promise Levy Oversight Committee. That's a very natural assignment for someone whose committee handles education. Now, her regional committees will include the King County Growth Management Planning Council, and that's very important because she is, her committee handles neighborhoods, and she is the representative for Council District 2, which is undergoing the most gentrification of any region of the city. So it's natural for her to sit on the Growth Management Planning Council, and she will be joined by Dan Strauss, who's on the Land Use Committee on the city council. So those two were the most natural folks to be sitting on the Growth Management Planning Council. Now, under state law, Washington state law has a Growth Management Planning Act that says that all of the jurisdictions under the state level are required to undergo a process of growth management planning. Okay. Can't just lift all permitting laws and allow growth to just run wild. You have to have a plan in place, and you have to have some regulations in place that manage growth in a way that isn't going to completely destroy the environment, and in a way that right now the state legislature is trying to also make that fair demographically to people based on their race. So to say that you will have a growth management plan in place is not enough. You also have to make sure that there is not redlining going on. You have to make sure that that all of your growth is not concentrated in the within communities of color. So that those folks end up being priced out and gentrified out of their own communities. So that's a process that is going on right now at the state legislature level, where folks are proposing bills to try to include those requirements within the Growth Management Plan Act. And it looks like Tammy Morales is also going to make that a concern of hers for regional growth management planning in the King County area, as well as the city of Seattle, but also the larger region of the four county area in Puget Sound. But she's sitting on the King County Growth Management Planning Council, so really focused on the King County area, which includes not just the city of Seattle, but other cities like Renton and Auburn and Kent and Federal Way and places east of Lake Washington, Bellevue, Issaquah, et cetera. So those rural areas too fall under the King County Growth Management Planning Council. Now, Tammy Morales will also sit on the King County Board of Health along with Teresa Mosqueda and Lisa Herbold. So she also has an interest in what the King County Board of Health decides in terms of COVID-19 and other health-related issues, including funding of hospitals and the management of health for the residents of King County. Now, Shama Sawant's committee on the city council is the Sustainability and Renters Rights Committee, and her regional committee assignments include the Advisory Committee on Aging and Disability Services and the King County Regional Water Quality Committee, and she will sit on that committee alongside Alex Peterson. Now, that may sound weird. Why would Alex Peterson, who heads the Transportation Committee, sit on the Water Quality Committee? Well, his committee also handles the Seattle Public Utilities, which has to do with wastewater and drinking water. Mm-hmm. So that's also a natural for him. But also remember the transportation. Our state's transportation infrastructure has a very high impact on our salmon streams and the process of habitat restoration. I'll talk about that a little bit later in the show today. And so it also makes a lot of sense that whoever has the transportation planning also should be looking at wastewater, particularly road runoff, and the ways in which transportation block fish passage through our Western Washington streams. So that's kind of a natural for Alex Peterson. And then finally, Sarah Nelson's committee on the city council is it's about other things besides economic development, but we can look at her regional committee assignments and see that she's really leaning heavily into the economic development piece of her work. And so her regional committee assignments really reflect that. The Economic Development Council of Seattle and King County is one of her assignments. Also, the Puget Sound Regional Council Economic Development Board. And finally, Visit Seattle, which used to be called the Seattle Convention and Visitors Bureau. So she's going to be leaning heavily into her pro-business stance and just doing as much work as she can on behalf of business, not just on the city council, but also in King County and the Puget Sound region in general, the four county area. And then there are a few assignments that aren't obviously related to a council members work on the city council, and I just want to talk briefly about those. The King County Regional Policy Committee sets policy for various things that include all of King County and its municipalities within it. So sure, the King County Council passes a lot of bills and considers legislation that affects people within the unincorporated areas of King County and are not governed by a city within King County, like the city of Seattle or the city of Renton, for example. But the King County Regional Policy Committee really looks at the full county and tries to coordinate between those cities and the King County Council to come up with policies that everybody can kind of have a consensus on and get on board with so that everybody's not operating in their separate silos. Okay. So members of each of the city councils and, members of the King County Council sit on these regional committees, on these King County regional committees. And the policy committee is the one that sets the policy for things, that include health and human services, public lands, affordable housing, homelessness, waste management, roads, emergency planning, county levies, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of different things. The two representatives from the Seattle City Council who will be sitting on that council are Andrew Lewis and Shama Sawant. So, so that's kind of an interesting pairing, and interesting that two of the more progressive council members are the ones who will be our representatives to the King County Regional Committee. Now, there's a similar group called the Puget Sound Regional Council, and that's the committee that's supposed to coordinate King County with Pierce County, Snohomish County, and Kitsap County for the entire Puget Sound region. It does the same, literally the same thing. It's just a bigger body. It makes planning decisions about growth management, economic development, and big transportation projects in the Puget Sound region in that four-county area. And it has about 100 members on the full assembly, including representatives of the various cities, towns, ports, and tribal governments within that four-county area. Now, the Puget Sound Regional Council has an executive board that carries out a lot of the work in between meetings of the full assembly. The City of Seattle, the City Council sends 3 members to sit on the executive board, and this year that's Andrew Lewis, Tammy Morales, and Dan Strauss. So it's really interesting to see Andrew Lewis kind of step up and be the representative for the city to the county and to the broader Puget Sound region. Mm-hmm. That's a big role for him. But I think, getting his hands dirty working on the King County Regional Homelessness Authority has maybe whetted his appetite for doing more work similar to that. And kind of interesting to also see Tammy Morales and Dan Strauss on the bigger Puget Sound Regional Council. I think it really points out that Tammy Morales is seeing the solution for the concerns of her constituents as something that has to be looked at in a broader context than just Seattle City politics. And I think she's correct about that. Right. Yeah, now the Puget Sound Regional Council has a growth management policy board to handle growth management issues for the four-county area. And Andrew Lewis and Dan Strauss will sit on that board. That's a natural for Dan Strauss since he's on the Land Use Committee on the Seattle City Council. That appointment would fall to him naturally. But again, Andrew Lewis stepping up to work on bigger issues in a broader context. And Andrew Lewis will also sit on the operations committee, for the Puget Sound Regional Council, which makes decisions on the budget, contracts, and personnel issues for the Puget Sound Regional Council as a whole. Okay. So I think that's a very interesting appointment too. Yeah. Now, just a couple more boards I want to talk about. There's the Sound Transit Board, which is separate from the King County Regional Transit Committee, which runs Metro Transit. Sound Transit is the board that specifically runs Sound Transit. It's Tri-County Area Bus System and the Light Rail System. Alex Peterson is not Seattle's representative to Sound Transit. This year, again, it's Deborah Juarez who will continue on in that post. So I think that's a very interesting thing. I think it's Deborah Juarez saying we need continuity on Sound Transit, but I think it's also her not wanting to give up control of an appointment that she really, enjoys, I think, having the power to oversee Sound Transit. And, I think people should be maybe paying a little more attention to how the Sound Transit Board runs and makes decisions and what her role is in that. It would be kind of interesting to see, okay, why did she hang on to that board membership?
It'll
be interesting to see. Now the final board. Oh, did you want to say something, Mike?
No, I said that's a good question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now the final board I want to talk about is the Association of Washington Cities. The AWC lobbies the state legislature and the U.S. Congress on behalf of all of Washington's cities and towns. And it has been in operation since the 1930s when it was founded. Now, the AWC's board of directors runs that organization. And there are two Seattle City Council members who sit on the board of directors. And that's Teresa Mosqueda and Dan Strauss. And I find it kind of interesting that Deborah Juarez, who is the city council president and would normally represent the city council's interests to a broader group, particularly Congress and the state legislature, is not interested in this assignment. But Deborah Juarez instead is taking on the Seattle International Affairs Advisory Board. So I think that tells you a little bit about her and maybe about what her ambition is in the future. I don't think she's going to want to stay a city council member forever. It looks like she may be interested in running for U.S. Congress or maybe getting an appointment to work on foreign affairs in a future national administration, Democrat administration. So that's kind of interesting that she's not interested in working on the Association of Washington Cities to lobby for the interests of the city of Seattle. But she is very interested in the International Affairs Advisory Board. So, and I should point out too, the International Affairs Advisory Board has a heavy leaning towards helping businesses in this region deal with international trade. So that also kind of shows you what her interests are. So that's the wrap up of the regional committees. Just so folks know, being a city council member isn't all about city politics. It's about a broader range of coordination and policy planning and decision making.
All right. Well, moving on, more developments this week regarding
police Seattle accountability.
Bus. Yeah.
Yeah. There's new news on the Seattle Police Department's disinformation campaign from June 8th, 2020. The South Seattle Emerald had another great article by Carolyn Bick entitled "Email Reveals Even City Officials Fell Victim to 2020 Proud Boys Hoax." Okay. So Bick received an email from a manager at Seattle Public Utilities, which shows that the Proud Boys hoax on June 8th, 2020 was not just a few minutes of evening chatter on the Seattle Police radio band to scare George Floyd protesters after the Seattle Police Department had abandoned the East Precinct building. It was a hoax that started at least 3 hours earlier, possibly earlier than that, and it involved multiple city officials from different departments. The wording of the email made it clear that the Seattle Public Utilities manager and the director of the Seattle Office of Emergency Management both knew about so-called, quote, intelligence reports that the Proud Boys group may be active in the area, end quote. The email also states that the Seattle Department of Transportation, Seattle Public Utilities, and other departments, possibly the Parks Department, were working to make the area safer in light of the potential risks. And it says, quote, compared to earlier intel, tonight has the possibility to be much more violent should a counter-protest develop, end quote. The counter-protest, of course, being the Proud Boys, right? Now, the Seattle Public Utilities manager told Bick that he didn't remember which police officers passed this along in their briefing, But apparently these department heads were briefed earlier in the day on this by someone from the Seattle Police Department who passed along that disinformation, right? It does show that the lie originated earlier than the Office of Police Accountability Investigation revealed, and that it spread much further through city government, causing multiple departments to spend time and taxpayer money addressing a risk that did not exist. Okay? That's the key point here. Now, Bick also reminds us that Andrew Meyerberg, the head of the OPA, should have looked into whether the lie was spread to other city departments, since he used to work as an attorney in the Office of Emergency Management. So he should have known to ask if the Proud Boys hoax had caused any other city departments to muster up personnel and resources to address it when it was in fact not actually occurring. And interestingly, our new mayor, Bruce Harrell, recently had asked the director and assistant director of the Office of Emergency Management if they knew at the time that there was a ruse going on June 8th when the SPD spread that rumor. They confirmed to him that they indeed took that intel seriously and that they did not know that it was a hoax. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I see that you have audio available from this week's Community Police Commission meeting. Again, just a reminder to folks, the Community Police Commission is meant to be the civilian oversight body of the Seattle Police Department, which takes public testimony and comments on policy at the Seattle Police Department, although it does not have the power to subpoena testimony or to issue discipline to any police officers. So in this audio, you're going to hear three people. First, you'll hear the Seattle Police Department representative on the Community Police Commission, that's Officer Mark Mullins, asking the other members a question. Then you'll hear the Reverend Harriet Walden. She's one of the co-chairs of the Community Police Commission. And then finally, you'll hear Austin Field, who is another Community Police Commission member. He is a law student at the University of Washington with pretty good legal underpinnings for his work on the CPC. So go ahead and cue up the audio, Mike.
All right. And I also want to just point out that they were discussing a letter that CPC was going to be sending out.
Yeah, and I'll talk about that after the audio portion.
Okay, and we're going to break this into two pieces, so we'll begin.
We'll talk about the first half, and then you'll play the second half, and we'll talk about that.
You are correct. Here goes.
Oh, yeah, Officer Miller.
I'm not completely understanding what, not to say that it was wrong or right, but what the complete objection to the radio ruse, as I understand it, what is the what would be the main problem with it? I guess I would say.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody can tell me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a few things. I mean, Reverend Walden, go ahead. Is he raised?
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Well, thank you, Officer Mullen, for that question. One of the first things is that it went out to city departments and city.
Oh, I lost you.
Reverend Walden, we lost your sound.
Reverend Walden.
And to say that in a time of already heightened activity in Seattle was just like it was worse than a bad joke. I mean, it had city agencies now who have sent emails said that they were preparing. I mean, and it came from the emergency operations center. And so if an email went from the emergency operations center to other departments in the city, the departments in the city was preparing for an event.
Okay. The way I understood it, it was broadcast over the radio, not an email. I didn't understand.
Well, that's because the investigation wasn't as thorough as it could have been, and there's also new information that previous OPA director had managed had been in the emergency operation center at one time in his career. and did not, you know, there was not a thorough investigation on this. I think that was the main problem. It's not a thorough investigation. It did go out to other seas, other agencies, for them to prepare. I mean, if you think the powers are coming, do you need more help? I mean, what do you need in Seattle if they're coming? When we've already got a protest going on. That's all, like putting fire in the theater.
I see Austin's hand is raised. So go ahead, Austin.
Yeah, I just want to thank Reverend Walden for what she said and agree with all that. I mean, this was just SPD inciting a public panic. There was no tactical reason to make the city think that was an armed group of white nationalists roving around when there wasn't. And then on top of that, you have the fact that the Seattle Police Department sent, you know, more officers to the Capitol riot than any other department. And the Capitol riot was a Proud Boy organized event. And so to make up a rumor that there's Proud Boys walking around, and then a few months later have Seattle police officers standing shoulder to shoulder with Proud Boys at the Capitol building, that's a very troubling sequence of events. Because at the end of the day, there just wasn't any reason to do this. This, as Reverend Walden said, this created a public panic, and it made the Seattle Police Department a source it caused the Seattle Police Department to produce a lack of public safety rather than creating public safety. And that is just unacceptable.
Okay, so we're going to pause it there and talk a little bit about that. It kind of says it all right there, right? Community Police Commissioner Austin Field saying, look, it produced the opposite effect from what the Seattle Police Department's remit is, which is to make the city safer. It actually made things more dangerous by making folks within the Chop Chaz area arm up and turn barriers that the police had left in front of the East Precinct building. They moved those out into the street and barricaded and got ready for what they thought would be a violent confrontation with the Proud Boys. Reverend Harriet Walden makes the point of, hey, you know, the email was sent out by the Office of Emergency Management to other city departments saying we need to prepare for this. And that meant using, paying personnel overtime because these preparations went well into the evening of June 8th. It meant, spending a lot of taxpayer money to address a threat that did not exist. Okay. And I found it kind of interesting that the Seattle Police Department representative on the Community Police Commission is just kind of sitting there going, I don't see anything wrong with it. Tell me what was wrong with it. Right. So there's another part to this where the, SPD representative on the commission tries to reframe what Austin Field just said, and he attacks him for a semantic error by saying that, you know, the SPD didn't officially send representatives to the January 6th, riot. But on the other hand, I'd have to say that we know now that the Seattle Police Department had more personnel there than any other, police agency in the United States. Okay. So, let's hear that part too.
Can I say something very quickly? I think we need to be careful about our words when we say SPD sent officers to the Capitol. We didn't send officers to the Capitol.
Well, now that's true, but it's also my understanding that not all the officers that attended that event were terminated. Some of them remain on the force.
Well, some of them didn't participate in the way that happened to be illegals. But I mean, I don't want to.
But they were still at a Proud Boys sponsored event, just to clarify.
Okay. that you're starting to get into constitutional things.
Sure.
That if you were there and you didn't participate, or if you were in the area and you didn't participate, or you went back to your hotel, there's a whole bunch of things involved in whether or not the department or anyone could do anything about them being in Washington, D.C. So I just want to be careful about our words when we say SPD sent officers to the Capitol. That's not true. Officers went on their own recognizance. They went there. They paid their own way. This was not a sponsored event by any organization connected to the police department. Those officers went on their own. They made their own choice to go there. So I just want to be careful when we say we sent officers to the Capitol. We didn't do that.
That's fair. But my main point is the loss of public trust that something like this creates, because you have the police. I'm talking about the Proud Boys lie here right now.
Okay. Okay. Well, I don't want to call it a lie.
It wasn't true.
I just want to encourage folks to speak one at a time, if it's possible, just so we don't end up kind of speaking over one another. So.
Sure. I'm sorry. Go ahead, sir.
No, go ahead, Officer Mull.
Okay, I don't want to call it a ruse. I don't want to call it a lie. I would rather call it a ruse. There are some tactical reasons why they did it. Now, was it a mistake to do it tactically? Because you can make tactical mistakes and decisions that don't work out or become a liability or a danger to people. That's possible. But I wouldn't call it a lie. We've gotten into problems before with the ruse, and I understand the contention, but I would say that we need to lean and look at what was the tactical reasons for why they announced that.
What were the? I mean, we have an investigation that says that tactically it was pretty indefensible.
Well, there might have been a situation with trying to move people out of an area, which I'm not saying is right or wrong. I'm just saying there were tactical reasons for why they announced that. And also, we know that people listen to our radio and that they react to our radio and they try to get advantages by listening to our radio.
All right.
Okay, so that's the end of the clip. I had to mute my microphone there because I was starting to laugh and guffaw a little bit. But so unpacking some of what you heard there, essentially Officer Mullins saying, you know, first off, using that excuse, you know, the SPD didn't send officers to the Capitol. They went on their own recognizance, and then assuming that there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and trying to stick with the bogus defense that, you know, being a bystander, you know, some of these officers were actually bystanders. Yeah, right. They bought plane tickets. They booked hotel rooms to go to D.C. to be a bystander who just kind of was caught on the sidewalk, you know, when the riot happened. Well, that's not true. They actually bought their plane tickets and bought their hotel rooms to be a part of an event that was organized by the Proud Boys. Austin Field is absolutely right about that. He's also absolutely right that the OPA has not disciplined those officers adequately for that, and that the Seattle Police Department needs to own up to the fact that they have white supremacists within the ranks and do something about it. Now, also, when Mullins says that, I hesitate to call it a lie, right? And then Austin Fields comes back and says, well, it's not true. You know, what other definition is there of a lie, right? Mm-hmm. And then Officer Mullins goes on to say, well, it was a tactical error, you know, and people make mistakes, right? Well, the problem with that, and then he acknowledges that there have been problems with hoaxes in the past and what he calls ruses in mm-hmm. the past. And that is Councilmember Lisa Herbold's point, which is that the Seattle Police Department has a history of using ruses and of there being problems with that, including the person who committed suicide because of a SPD ruse. Okay. The real problem here, Herbold asserts, is that the Seattle Police Department has kept no records, does not track their use of ruses, and there's no evaluation of whether or not the SPD should just abandon that as a tactic and a strategy because it does not work and does not produce a good result and more often produces a terrible result as it did in this situation. So, after that meeting that you heard the excerpt from, the Community Police Commission did release their statement at the end of the week about the Proud Boys hoax. Mm-hmm. And within the statement, you can tell that Reverend Walden and Austin Field kind of won the argument. Okay, because I'm going to do a couple of quotes here from the statement. They called the Proud Boys hoax this, quote, this lie, which came one day after a protester was shot, was irresponsible, unprofessional, unethical, and unacceptable. It almost certainly escalated tensions in the CHOP CHAZ, impacted other city departments, had a chilling effect on free speech, and in hindsight, raises the specter of the six SPD officers who participated in the January 6th attempted coup, end quote. And then the statement goes on to condemn the OPA's lame investigation. Now, here's another quote. The fact that this investigation was completed in September 2021, but not released until December 30th, 2021, is concerning in and of its own. It raises questions about why no one in SPD exposed the ruse earlier, why OPA delayed the release of its investigation, how that delay negatively impacted the outcomes and potential findings that could lead to officer discipline, and broader concerns about the recent announcement that OPA Director Meyerberg has been appointed Public Safety Director in the Harrell administration, end quote. And that kind of says it all, right? Mm-hmm. So I particularly like that they point out that the OPA delayed the release of its investigation until after the two supervisors who the OPA would have disciplined if they had released their, that the SPD would have had to discipline if the OPA had released their results in a timely manner, were already gone and had already left the department. So
it also, they don't mention it in the letter, but there's been multiple concerns raised about the timing in relation to the election for mayor and city council yes. positions.
Yes, there is that too. If this had come out before the elections, it may have impacted who was elected mayor and who was elected in the city council position 9 that Lorena Gonzalez was vacating and that Sarah Nelson won. And it may also have been harder for Ann Davison to win election to the city attorney's office.
Well, and given that Andrew Meyerberg got his position pushed through from Bruce Harrell and
Monisha Harrell?
No, the former city council member, Mayor Tim.
Tim Burgess.
Tim Burgess. Those were the two primary people Bruce that Harrell. Pushed him for that position.
Yeah, Bruce Harrell's propaganda minister.
It's intriguing that after that came out in city council and Andrew Meyerberg spoke there, that he later that day was then moved into the Harrell administration. And I think that needs a lot more focus than what it's currently receiving.
Yeah. definitely. So that is the state of police accountability in the city. I think we're seeing that, as soon as I saw that Bruce Harrell had appointed Andrew Meyerberg as his public safety director, I just kind of shook my head and I was thinking, you know, as if we needed more proof that the OPA is part of the good old boys network, you know. Here's the real proof, right? You know, Bruce Harrell has been talking about the sum total of his police accountability suggestions during the debates leading up to the election was, oh, I'm just going to make every officer watch a video and sign a statement saying that they won't use excessive force, and that will be good enough. Right. Yeah. And that appears to be the attitude of someone like Andrew Meyerberg. And apparently he was a good fit for Bruce Harrell in those terms. And I think that really proves that the OPA is not doing its job, and that the Office of the Inspector General, which is supposed to oversee the OPA, is not doing its job either. A lot of people not doing their job. That's right. Mm. So let's talk about a few other things coming up.
Just about 12 minutes left.
Yeah. So we have a local election. You've probably already got your ballot in the mail, like me, for Seattle School District levies. This happens regularly in February. It's the usual school levy elections, with school levies in multiple school districts throughout Washington State, particularly here in Western Washington. There are two items on the City of Seattle School District ballot. One is Proposition 1, which is the replacement levy for educational programs and operations. This levy replaces the one that's expiring. It will be a property tax of 74 cents per $1,000 assessed value in 2023, and then it increases a penny for the years 2024 and 2025. Now, the anti-tax crowd is arguing that the state legislature, quote unquote, fixed the funding for schools in response to the McCleary ruling, but we know that there are problems with the legislature's fix. It helped a lot of rural school districts at the expense of urban and suburban school districts. And that's why you're seeing so many of the urban and suburban districts in King County have levies on the ballot this year, from Shoreline in the north to Federal Way to Renton here in King County. So, yes, schools need more money, particularly urban and suburban school districts. So vote yes to provide enough funding for the school districts here in the City of Seattle. Now, also on the ballot is Proposition 2. That's the replacement capital levy for buildings, technology, and academics and athletics infrastructure. And this levy is particularly important for earthquake retrofitting and the expensive air filtration and ventilation systems that are needed to address COVID-19. But it will also pay for things like energy efficiency upgrades, technology for classrooms, renovations so that your kids are not going to school in schools with peeling paint and falling ceiling tiles or leaks in the roof. And it will also pay for athletic fields and facilities. It's a six-year levy that starts with a property tax of 47 cents per $1,000 assessed value, then decreases to 37 cents by the end of the six-year period. So it goes down by a couple of pennies each year. And again, if supporting the education of children is one of your priorities, and it really should be, you should vote yes.
Well, and it's important, too, to point out that schools are also used for non-school activities. A lot of them are community meeting places, and so they serve multiple purposes beyond just being for teaching kids.
Yes, that's very true. Everything from community meetings with your county or state representatives to areas where Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous meetings happen. Schools are very, very important infrastructure for the community, whether you're a child or an adult. Mm-hmm. Okay. So also, the state legislature is in session now. The state legislature is now nearing the end of its second week. It's a short 60-day session this year, so the legislature has to move quickly to pass bills. There are a huge number of bills introduced so far, about 2,551 at the last count. And this year, the state has a windfall of $898 million over the forecast revenue for this coming year. So they have money to spend, which is kind of interesting. Folks have been, you know, politicians have been saying, hey, I have my priorities of where I want the state legislature to spend more money. But then there's Maria's priorities, my own priorities. And they really fall into two categories. One is the environment and the other is the built environment. Okay. So the, for me, the environment right at the top of my list is fish culverts. Okay. I know that sounds weird and people are rolling their eyes saying, you know, why are fish important when people need housing? But I have to say, yes, people do need housing, but we're not seeing the human race losing 80% of our population like we're seeing with salmon runs, trout runs, trout streams and steelhead runs. Okay. And the state lost a lawsuit where they tried, where we tried to make the federal government pay for the replacement of road culverts in order to free up streams and gullies for fish passage. And the state lost that lawsuit. So it's really now the state has to come up with the money and they have to move forward and they have to replace those barriers to fish passage. They should also put money into habitat restoration. That includes restoring the banks of streams and rivers and planting trees, even if it means providing incentives to private landowners to do that. I think that's extremely important if we want to recover our fish runs. Now, last year, in early 2021, the estimates were for an increase in fish runs. What we actually saw was that there was a small increase in the lower reaches of rivers, and there was a decrease of up to 30% in the upper reaches of our Western Washington rivers for fish runs. So even, and this year again, the estimate is that we're going to have amazing fish runs. Well, we'll see, right? Yeah. The trend is not looking, the actual trend of the amount of fish returning to spawn is not looking good. Okay. So the state needs to hop on that right away. Other things for the environment include things like electric vehicle charging stations and statewide rail. I think those are two very important things to get people out of their gas-guzzling cars. We need the state to really focus on those two things. And then in, as part of the built environment, my two priorities are that stand head and shoulders above all the other human needs in the state are more mental health beds, whatever that takes. To provide more mental health intake beds for people who need to be stabilized and for people who need long-term treatment and more affordable housing. So those are the two priorities in the built environment that I really care about. Now, two bills have already passed the House and both relate to the Washington CARES Long-Term Care Fund. House Bill 1732 will delay the collection of the 58%, the 0.58% payroll tax until July 1st, 2023. That's the middle of next year. It would also allow older workers who are near retirement to collect prorated benefits if they're not fully vested in the program when they retire. And then the other one, House Bill 1733, will allow some people who would never receive benefits under the Washington CARES Long-Term Act to opt out of paying the payroll tax. That includes people who work in Washington state but live across the border in another state like Idaho or Oregon. Also, workers with non-immigrant visas, partners of active military personnel, and some disabled veterans who won't receive benefits can also opt out of the tax. These two bills passed the House and they're now on their way to the state Senate and they're moving rather rapidly through the state Senate. So that appears to be a priority for Democrats this year to get the WACARES long-term fund into a good shape so that people will want to participate and contribute their taxes to it. Now, a couple of bills are getting a lot of press, including Senate Bill 5670 and its companion House Bill 1782. These two bills would allow the construction of sixplexes on residential lots within a half-mile radius of a major transit hub within Washington cities with populations of 20,000 people or more. They would also allow all fourplexes on all, they would allow fourplexes on all residential lots in cities of 20,000 or more, and duplexes on all residential lots in cities of at least 10,000 people. So some statewide zoning changes there that would allow more density in our cities and towns. And then there's House Bill 1337, which is meant to provide financial incentives to cities and towns that provide better zoning for accessory dwelling units or mother-in-law apartments. That one's also kind of getting some press. And then finally, Senate Bill 5428 would exempt certain types of transitional housing and tiny home villages from the state's environmental review process so that, to speed up the construction of shelter for the homeless. So that's another bill that is getting some press and some push in the legislature. So as usual, you can find more information on bills and look up bills that you might be interested in on the Washington State Legislature's website, which is leg.wa.gov.
All right.
Okay. How are we doing for time? Just a couple minutes? A
couple minutes left. What would you like to...
Okay, I just want to talk a little bit about the Washington State Supreme Court decision this week that upheld the $18 million fine against the Grocery Manufacturers Association in a victory for taxpayers. Back in 2013, Washington voters were asked to vote on Initiative 522, which would have required labeling of genetically modified foods in Washington state. And that initiative was gaining a lot of ground. Then the Grocery Manufacturers Association, a big lobbying group for large national and international corporate food companies, stepped in and they spent $11 million to advertise against and defeat the initiative. They tried to hide the names of the companies that contributed to their election fund until Attorney General Bob Ferguson sued to get a hold of that information. That included companies like Nestle, Coca-Cola, and General Mills. Okay. In 2020, 7 years after the election took place, an appeals court finally ruled against the Grocery Manufacturers Association and levied an $18 million fine, a new record for a violation of Washington State's campaign finance laws. The Grocery Manufacturers Association then appealed to the state Supreme Court, and now the Supreme Court has upheld the fine and ordered the Grocery Manufacturers Association to also reimburse the state for its attorney's costs, which over 8 years now adds up to quite a bit of money, right? Mm-hmm. So, of course, the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which has since renamed itself as the Consumer Brands Association, wants to appeal this decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. But, of course, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court, I don't think, has any jurisdiction over state law. So, obviously, this is just a delaying tactic. It's a legal maneuver to try to delay having to actually pay that money. And it's the kind of thing where you hope that eventually a court can finally rule, yes, we agree with that original appeals court decision, and now we're tacking on interest. That's what I always feel when I see these delaying tactics where there's a big fine and the companies, or the, in this case, the representative of these companies is playing this delaying game, is that I hope eventually a court will be able to say, slap them down and say, nope, the original court ruling is good. And now because you've spent 8 years or a decade or so dragging this out, there's interest on top of that that you now have to pay. But we'll see. They may dissolve and say we don't have the resources. That's often the what happens.
Yeah, fold the company, ruling, create a new one.
Yeah, but the ruling is great because it essentially says that if you violate state campaign laws, try to hide who your donors are, there are serious consequences. You know, not everyone has the legal resources that someone like the Grocery Manufacturers Association has to fight this thing. But this ruling is great because it's a precedent that can help to provide, help to ensure that future groups that engage in campaigning and supporting or trying to shoot down legislation or initiatives or other candidates will disclose their funders.
All right.
Okay.
Well, we're going to have to cut you off there.
That's all right.
There's always next week.
There is.